America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. The fall of Kabul over a year ago still remains vivid in all of our minds. We can see the images of Afghans desperate to find a way out, knowing what Taliban rule might mean for them and their families, particularly if they assisted the American fighting forces in any way. Our guest was an interpreter for our soldiers and has very passionate, well-informed opinions about how all of this went down. He's next here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Jamil Hassan, and he's written a book called Promises Betrayed, an Afghan interpreter at the fall of Kabul. The foreword, by the way, for the book was written by General David Petraeus. Obviously, you met many important American military officials throughout the course of your time as an interpreter for the Americans in Afghanistan. And you start your book with a portrayal of what was happening in those final few days, particularly for someone like you and your family right on the ground. We were watching it, of course, from afar. It looked horribly difficult as a situation for any human being to be in. Just give us a sense again of what that was like for you and your family.
Well, it's one thing to see something on the TV, but it's totally different to experience it on yourself. On the 15th of August, 2021, I was at home supervising a group of painters painting a room for my brother's wedding, which was due in 15 days. And I got a call from my brother-in-law, who was at the Afghanistan Central Passport Directorate, called me. He said that he asked me if I was at home. I said, yes. And he said, don't leave because there are Taliban everywhere. Though we knew that they were taking districts one after another and provinces one after another, but it was absolutely unbelievable to capture the capital so quickly and without a resistance. Even the Taliban themselves did not expect that. And then for 3 days, I stayed at home. My family did not allow me to leave home. And on the fourth day of the Taliban's takeover of Kabul on the 18th of August, I got a text from a friend in Italy about an evacuation by the Italians. I grabbed my family, my wife, and my young daughter, and we rushed to the airport, passing multiple Taliban checkpoints, to taking all the risks that were, and of course it was worth it. It was better to take the risk than live under the Taliban. So we got to the airport only to learn that evacuation by the Italians was canceled. We were asked to return home and come back in 3 days. I and many of my other colleagues, we did not want to take the risk. We stayed there for the night there. And in the middle of the night, the following day, on August the 19th, I showed my SIV, Special Immigrant Visa, documents to the U.S. Marines at the Kabul airport gate. And luckily, they allowed us to cross the gate and into the airport. And then the real chaos, the real disaster, the real life and death journey began from inside the airport. That may surprise you. All these terrible things that happened to me and my family started after entering the Kabul airport, because there was absolute chaos, a scene that I will never forget in my life. For over 36 hours, under heat, cold, dust, and mud and everything you can imagine, we were there standing without any food, any water. I was separated from my wife and daughter for 13 hours. She had cried. She thought I was killed and I was trampled and something bad had happened to me. But luckily, I reunited with my family. And then after 36 hours, we were evacuated to Qatar, where because of lack of buses to take us to the places that we should have been taken, we stayed on the tarmac under 50 degrees Celsius for 8 straight hours, and that resulted in one Afghan evacuee fainting every 30 minutes. And then after 24 hours in Qatar, we were taken to Germany, where we spent a week under very cold and harsh conditions, and the accommodations were not good. The food was not enough, and things that I have all mentioned in my book with very much details. And then we were evacuated to Virginia, and following that to Wisconsin, where we spent 65 days in a U.S. military base called Fort McCoy. And after that, we self-departed. That's the term they use. We self-departed from Wisconsin to Northern California to join my two brothers and their family.
What an amazing story. And I was wondering how reminiscent you think that story is of so many other experiences, and if you had to grade yours compared to the hundreds of thousands of people, including family members, who might qualify to get out but are still in Afghanistan, how would you look at your own experience in relation to others?
Well, though I have written this book, Promises Betrayed, An Afghan Interpreter of the Fall of Kabul, but it represents tens of thousands of Afghan interpreters and translators and hundreds of thousands of Afghan families who risk their lives to take the chance to be evacuated to safety to different countries across the world. And absolutely, the ordeals that other Afghans face were more terrible than mine and that of my family. I can give you the example of the suicide attack that happened after we left Kabul that killed 13 U.S. service members and 170 Afghans, and 200 more were injured. Along the journey, I have met lots of other people who are separated from their families. Actually, me and my family, we are the luckiest ones. We are safe, we are together, and here we are in the United States. There are families who are separated along the journey. How one member of the family is, for example, in Ukraine, the other is in Kosovo. Half of the family is here in the United States. The other half is in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, the immigration process, the bureaucratic process, the red tapes, they all prevent them from reuniting in a foreseeable future. And for those who have been left behind, it's more terrible, not only security-wise, but also economic-wise. The poverty level is very severe in Afghanistan. More than 20 million people, more than half of Afghanistan's population, is under poverty line, especially the interpreters and translators and members of Afghan National Defense and Security Forces, who were the main allies of the U.S. and the West in its global war on terror. They are hiding in their homes. They cannot leave their homes because their lives are threatened by the Taliban. And because of that, they are facing severe economic conditions, and they can barely feed their family. 2 days ago, I got a text on my Facebook Messenger from a lady in Afghanistan. She was begging me for help, because they think that I am now a big guy because I have a book in the United States, which is not true. I'm just an ordinary Afghan refugee here now. And she was helping, she was asking for my help if I could just send them some money, because she said she was feeding her children with basically roasted bread. And her husband wasn't a police, and he got killed last August. So these are the terrible situations that Afghans are facing. It's not only in Afghanistan. We have Afghans who are promised to be evacuated to safety in Pakistan, in African countries, in UAE, in Qatar, even in Ukraine. They are stuck there. They cannot return back. They cannot return to Afghanistan. And unfortunately, it's not clear when and if they will be evacuated to countries like the United States, Canada, the UK, and other EU countries.
Jamil, what is going right, if anything, is we read about the special immigrant visa program for those who work for the U.S. We see that there's an attempt to pass something called the Afghan Adjustment Act. We read that the administration has sought to accelerate processing through various immigration channels. What is working, in your view?
Things have improved a lot since last year. But the problem did not start last year. It began way before that. The Special Immigrant Visa Program, I believe, began in 2008. And I've read an article about this, that since 2008 until 2020, only eight people in the Department of State were assigned for Special Immigrant Visas applicants. So you can imagine the level of lack of attention towards the Afghan people. And now there are only 50 people, 50, which is compared to the 180,000 Afghans eligible for SIV. It is nothing. So we need more people to be assigned to this process to expedite it more than it's now. But as I said earlier, there are signs of improvement. This AAA is a good sign because it will give the chance for those who have been to the United States on humanitarian parole to get their green cards and stay here, and they will not be fearful of sending back to Afghanistan. And there are signs of improvement in the SIV process. I can see that. I'm hearing that from my friends, that they have removed some of the steps, and it's now much better. But still, there are issues that needs to be taken care of to help those left behind.
What about the Afghan Adjustment Act? That would give a path to permanent status rather than having to apply for asylum in this backlog system that we have. Where do you see that going?
I'm tracking that with many of my other colleagues who are U.S. citizens now, Afghan Americans. They are trying to push for it very hard. And as a matter of fact, some of them in the D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area, they are trying to make a rally in front of the Congress, the Capitol Hill, to try to ask the U.S. Congress to approve that so it will not force Afghans who were evacuated last year to apply for the asylum, because application for asylum is though it's easy in terms of applying, but in terms of being approved as an asylum, it's very hard, because one of the steps is that you have to provide threat letters issued by the Taliban stating your name, that your life is in danger, which is basically impossible for those who are already here. So that's a very good step, and I hope from the depth of my heart that it will be approved, so it gives a chance of breathe for my people here in the United States.
Jamil Hassan is with us. The book is called Promises Betrayed, and I think that tells you a lot about the thinking. Let's talk about your country, Afghanistan, and then I'll talk about the United States. First of all, who let you down the most? I'm reading where the ex-president, Ashraf Ghani, tried to explain why he fled as the Taliban moved in. Then, of course, when there was the Doha Agreement, evidently, we left out everyone in the government and negotiated directly with the Taliban. Explain what's going on in the country and who let you down in the process.
Well, we all knew that the war in Afghanistan could not have ended militarily. One way or the other, a peace deal needed to be signed to end this endless war once and for all. And we were very hopeful for that when the Doha Agreement was signed under President Trump's administration. But when the current U.S. administration delivered all the promises that it had made to the Taliban in the Doha Agreement, and they were done with their part, they should have asked the Taliban, they should have taken Taliban accountable for their actions and should have asked the Taliban to deliver their part of the promises, meaning the Taliban should have stopped attacking Afghan forces and Afghan civilians. They should have started negotiations with the Afghan government. One of the terms was that they should respect, preserve, and protect human rights and the achievements of the past 20 years of the democracy and freedom in Afghanistan, which they broke all their promises. The problem started with when President Biden suddenly announced that we will withdraw and give a specific deadline and timeline, which kind of incentivized the Taliban to push harder against the Afghan forces and take provinces one after another. And then when they approached Kabul, things got worse. But the real problem started from the very beginning of 2021 when the U.S. Administration started pulling out all the resources that were required for the maintenance and for the sustainment of the Afghan forces. I mean, contractors that were providing critical services for the Afghan Air Force and the U.S. military withheld providing critical ammunitions for the Afghan Air Force and Afghan Army. Those were the other steps that led to this chaos. Though the U.S. administration, the U.S. government, and its allies are mainly responsible for the failure, for the collapse of the Afghan government and the fall of my country back to the hands of Taliban, but they're not the only one to be blamed. The Afghan leaders, starting from the president and other political leaders, members of parliament, former warlords who were in power in Afghanistan, I have put all these in details in my book, as you said. They're all equally blamed. They should have stood with the people and they should have continued the fight against the Taliban. But generally, when you are fighting an enemy, the U.S. And the West was fighting alongside Afghan forces against the Taliban. But all of a sudden, things changed. They changed sides and they started negotiating with the Taliban, which we were expecting to be a good. But later on, they abandoned the Afghan forces, which was not a good sign. So to sum it up, if the U.S. Had taken Taliban accountable for their actions, for breaking their promises, if the U.S. had remained 2,500 force there to support the Afghan forces against the Taliban, meanwhile, when the negotiations was going on, we would have a power-sharing government between the Taliban and the former government of Afghanistan and a peaceful and a responsible withdrawal.
When do you think things began to perhaps get to a position where there was going to be, at best, a stalemate, at worst, what we ultimately saw? Was it when we went into Iraq that America got distracted? The fact that we were fighting to keep something from not happening in terms of another terrorist attack? What did you find about the esprit de corps of the Americans who were there, perhaps confused by their own government's policies over a very long stretch of time, the longest war America has ever been engaged in?
There are lots of issues that are that needs to be considered here, which, again, I am saying all these are in my book. When the Iraq war began, Afghanistan was kind of forgotten and pushed back. And then when President Bush announced that mission was accomplished in Afghanistan, that was another wrong announcement that went out. And then in 2010, when President Obama said put a deadline that we will first draw down our forces and then withdraw completely and hand over the security of Afghanistan to the Afghans themselves. That's when the Taliban decided to wait out the foreign forces, and that's what actually happened. The Taliban continued to fight the Afghan forces and their foreign advisors and supporters for 20 years. They took all the risks. They made so many sacrifices, the Taliban, I mean, and because they knew that one day or another, finally, the U.S. and its allies will withdraw from Afghanistan. So there were lots of mistakes, but the main thing that led to the Taliban's victory and takeover of Afghanistan was putting a timeline there for them, for the withdrawal of foreign forces, and pushing very hard. But look, there were lots of compromises made to the Taliban. For example, the first thing that was made was they were degraded from a terrorist group to an insurgency group because the U.S. does not negotiate with terrorists. Then the Afghan government was forced to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, among them suicide bombers and people who had killed Americans directly. These 5,000 people went back to the battlefield to fight against the Afghan foreigners there. There were again signs of improvement in this process. When President Trump signed the deal with the Taliban, he announced that any withdrawal will be condition-based, meaning if the Taliban remain committed to their promises, if they stop the attack on the Taliban and the Americans, and if they stop attacking Afghan civilians and so many other conditions were met, we will withdraw. Otherwise, we will be there, and we will see if conditions change. We will withdraw. Otherwise, we will be there. But then when President Biden again took the power here in the U.S., he was kind of hurrying with the Afghanistan thing. The problem is that Afghanistan was not a big issue. It's said in the introduction of my book that there are numbers that will provide a clear insight of on why the U.S. shouldn't have pulled out. You can see the comparison of the numbers from 2014 to 2021, when all the security responsibility was taken by the Afghan people, by the Afghan security forces. I mean, the casualties and the financial costs for the U.S. and its allies was very much low. It was, we can say, negligible. We cannot consider that as a cost. But the Afghan war was not a matter of improving your rating here in the United States for election or for other issues. But all of a sudden, he said that President Biden said that he did not want to pass this Afghan war to another president. And here we see the chaos, the aftermath of that decision, because of which the U.S. is now facing lots of problems, not only across the world, but also in the United States, across the world. I mean, now most countries around the world does not trust, I believe, the U.S. as a trustable ally. And because of pulling out of Afghanistan, Russia invaded Ukraine. Because
you see a link between that.
Of course,
that.
There is a link.
What about NATO and the U.S. both messing up at the end? Let's be very clear, in Afghanistan, and yet the way they've come together around Ukraine. What does that say to you?
A clear discrimination in all terms. It's not only about the war, it's about also the refugee crisis. Look, the Afghans are stuck there, left behind the main U.S. allies in the war on terror. They are still in Afghanistan and in other countries in refugee camps. But when the war in Ukraine began in four months, the U.S. Evacuated 100,000 Ukrainians to safety without anything. So there, and still this discrimination is going on. In one of the chapters of my book, there is this comparison of the situation in Ukraine and in Afghanistan with all these details. And of course, there is a link. Why didn't the China or Russia threaten or invaded any country in the past 20 years when the U.S. was in the region in Afghanistan? Now, I'm sure Japan, South Korea, some Middle East countries, they will be thinking of replacing the U.S. With other countries as an ally. So the United States image as the supreme leader of the free world, I think, is fading. Though it is late, it's not too late. We are talking about 30 million people in Afghanistan, and these are not numbers. These are human beings. Their lives are shattered. Their hopes are shattered. I will just give you a simple example.
Sure.
Afghanistan is the only country on earth that does not allow girls to go to school. You can imagine about the rest of it.
Let me ask you about that. How much had we raised the hopes and aspirations of the people of Afghanistan, particularly women? We saw some great activity going on. We were involved in nation building. We built a lot of infrastructure, a lot of facilities, a lot of schools. What happened to all of that in the course of the last year? And is that something that can be built upon again? Is there still some inkling, some shred of hope that still exists that some of that can be restored and recovered?
Well, the way Taliban took control of Afghanistan is it's difficult to push them out of that country again, because they're everywhere with $7 billion worth of military equipment left by the U.S. there and the NATO forces, and so many other things. I, again, have clear explanations like for all of these. We were on the right path for over 20 years. Look, here I am in the United States. Initially, I did not want to leave my country, though I had worked for over 8 years with foreign forces. I was an eligible SIV applicant. But as long as there was peace, there was hope in my country, I was happy there with my family, with my friends, in my own country, and I was okay with what was I was earning, what I was doing. I was studying for my master's degree and everything else. But I was forced to leave my country and leave my family behind, my friends, and all the achievements I had. This is just one simple example. We had over 7 million girls going to school. We had private universities that were offering PhD degrees in Afghanistan. We had so much achievements in all aspects of life. We had women serving as ministers. We had women serving as ambassadors for Afghanistan. And especially in large cities like Kabul, Herat, Kandahar, Jalalabad, these areas, the percentage of girls going to school was more than boys. And like everything was going in the right direction. And no one imagined that all of a sudden the West and Afghanistan's ally, the United States, would leave them to the Taliban. All these things are gone now. Girls cannot go to school. The freedom of speech is suppressed very hardly. People can't say anything against the Taliban. Like 2 months ago, I had a TV interview with one of the local channels in Afghanistan. And before the show started, they asked me to avoid saying anything against the Taliban, because it was a live show and it would create problems for them. So you can imagine the level of restrictions and put on people in Afghanistan. And what's more worrying is the economic situation. There is no employment for Afghans. All the government positions are occupied by the Taliban, and there is no. And because Taliban have not been recognized by the world or any other or any single country in the world, the Afghan businesses cannot trade with the world. And the import and export is basically stopped, kind of.
Does America have any leverage economically to say, look, if you want any aid whatsoever, here are the conditions that were not met, that must be met going forward in order to become part of some economic structure worldwide?
Yes, of course. If the U.S. really engages back with the Taliban properly, the way the Afghan wants, again, we could achieve some sort of gains there in Afghanistan. For instance, the last time the United Nations Security Council did not approve the lifting of sanctions or restrictions on Taliban for travel ban, that was a great move. We need to put more pressure on the Taliban to give in to the demands of the world, which are for human rights issues in Afghanistan. This helps a lot. The more the Taliban are pressurized, the better it is for the Afghan people there. But unfortunately, it hasn't been that severe for now. If the United States and the entire world can engage with the Taliban more, put them under more pressure, it will be better for people in Afghanistan. For example, the United Nations is engaged with the Taliban, but it provides aid. It does not ask the Taliban really to do something to change the life of the people there. And there are other ways as well, for like in private sector, if the world allows banks across the world to engage with Afghan businesses, it will help and improve the employment rate there. The money will not directly go to the Taliban, but it will benefit certain businesses in Afghanistan.
When we saw the taking out of the Al-Qaeda leader al-Zahari, and we heard about this strategy that America now employs with no one on the ground called Over the Horizon, what do you say about the implications of the terrorist threat and Taliban too? Are they as welcoming of outside agitators and terrorists as they were initially, and the reason that we did go in because of the attack on 9/11?
Well, the killing of the Al-Qaeda leader is something that needs to be looked in very deeply. There are certain questions in this regard that needs to be answered. Where was he for the past 20 years? Why did he suddenly appear in Kabul? I and many of my people believe that he was in Pakistan. He was brought into Kabul by the ISI, Pakistan's military intelligence branch, and handed, and the information was given to the CIA to remove him and eliminate the threat. And in exchange, the Pakistan was given $1.1 billion by the IMF. So these are all political decisions that are made, and this does not explain that the United States over the horizon strategy is working. It is not. If the United States was not able to eliminate the Taliban and Al-Qaeda with its presence in Afghanistan in 20 years, so how do you believe that it will be successful through the over-the-horizon operations to do so? It's not working. Though it may be able to eliminate certain targets there, but it is not really working there. We see that the Al-Qaeda is back in Afghanistan. ISIS is stronger than it was before. The ISIS is killing Taliban leaders. You can think of their power now. And there are other groups. Just for your information, it was not only the Al-Qaeda that killed 3,000 Americans on 9/11. The Taliban plus Al-Qaeda plus ISIS, they also killed more than 3,000 foreigners, foreign military people, contractors, and over 100,000 Afghans during the past 20 years in Afghanistan. And we can see that the CIA and the American government is saying nothing to these Taliban leaders who are still there. 10 of the Taliban government leaders right now are on the top of CIA's wanted list. So you can imagine of that. Well, like the Taliban's interior minister right now, he was responsible for Taliban's suicide attackers. He confessed that he sent more than 145 suicide attackers himself to target the foreigners and the Afghan forces. And we still see that he's out there running the government and just ruling the people with brutality.
Pakistan, what role do they play in all of this, and what kind of pressure can the United States put upon them and they upon the Taliban? What is the relationship there, and how important is it for us to understand the permeability of the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, again, I'm saying that it's everything in my book. Pakistan is the main target that should have been targeted 20 years ago for the 9/11 attacks. You see, all the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks were either Arab who traveled multiple times to Pakistan. The Al-Qaeda leader was killed in Pakistan. The Taliban leader was killed in Pakistan. The whole world knows that families of the current Taliban in Afghanistan are still in Pakistan. Actually, for us as an Afghan, the Taliban are Pakistanis. We do not consider them Afghans. We consider them Pakistan's puppets and Pakistan's trained militiamen who are running the country now. The whole world needs to pay attention to this. Since it's not only for the past 20 years, when the Soviets were in Afghanistan and the United States plus Saudi Arabia, they tried to get rid of the Soviets and the Soviet-backed government of Afghanistan, they used Pakistan, and Pakistan used them in exchange. Billions of dollars were sent to Pakistan to be distributed to Afghan Mujahideen, the resistance group against the Russians, the Soviets. Pakistan only provided a very small amount of that money to the Afghan Mujahideen and kept the rest for itself to build a very strong army and to build its nuclear bomb to stand strong against its arch rival, India. So it's all Pakistan. It was never about Afghanistan. It was never about the Taliban. It should have been always about Pakistan, and it's still. Look, here it is. 1 month after the Taliban took control of Kabul, Pakistan's ISI chief visited Afghanistan. Why would such a senior intelligence chief of the Pakistan army do so? It's all because they are running. And it's exactly like it was in the late 1990s. There are Pakistani military officers advising the Taliban what to be done. The Pakistan's ambassador in Afghanistan is basically running everything.
In closing, Jamil, let me ask you this. American veterans seem to be facing a harsh, sad reality that they really can't save their Afghan partners left behind by the U.S. But I know that many of them have been making a lot of private efforts, establishing their own nonprofit organizations, their own NGOs to try to do what it is that they can. What would you like to say about that effort? It's still ongoing, of course.
First of all, it was an absolute honor for me to serve alongside American and other foreign forces for 8 years in my country for democracy and freedom and for all the gains that we had achieved. I'm not regretful of any bit of it. It was an absolute honor for me. And we are grateful for those who were there last August to evacuate and to save hundreds of thousands of Afghans. And we appreciate and we recognize their sacrifices, especially the 13 U.S. service members. And there is no word to say how grateful we are. We are saved because of them. But still, there is opportunity for them if the United States government allows them. For example, they put a plan for the Ukrainians called Ally United for Ukraine. We still can have something like that, United for Afghanistan, to allow private citizens to continue their efforts of evacuating their Afghan allies. I have been following all the news, all the articles, all the books written about the evacuation and those who helped Afghans in very severe conditions. Two days ago, I watched an interview by a U.S. Special Forces veteran who and his team evacuated 500 Afghans through a sewage canal, taking everything off of that risk and other things. We are all grateful to them.
Jamil Hassan, the book is called Promises Betrayed, an Afghan interpreter at the fall of Kabul. And by the way, some of the proceeds from the sale of this incredible book are going to be donated to the Afghan evacuation and relief efforts. And Jamil, I cannot thank you enough for your service to our country, your country, and what you're still doing to educate all of us, because I think Americans, as you suggest, we looked away a long time ago, regretfully, and then we woke up to the horror of the end of this particular conflict, though we had looked away for so many years. And thank you for forcing us to think very hard and long about the commitment that we made and the impacts of the way we left. Thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
Thanks for having me.